Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with two members of the expert working group, which was the people who actually did a lot of the work for the Iraq Study Group. Of course, the Iraq Study Group released their report this Wednesday, and it has basically shaken the Capitol to its core and the White House as well. And we'll be looking into some of the findings in this report and speculate on what the president may do with this information. We'll begin in a moment with Chaz Freeman, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He's also been Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies and Director of Chinese Affairs at the State Department. And as I mentioned, he served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group, a member of the Expert Working Group on Strategy. He'll also be joined by Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute, who served as the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department at their Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. He was also Chief of the INR's Arabian Peninsula, Iran and Iraq Division, and the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups from 1990 to 2002. And he has served as a member of the Expert Working Group on Strategy. Then we'll be joined by Dr. Stephen Biddle, who is a Senior Fellow of Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battles. We'll look into the limited options that the president has militarily and diplomatically. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. In addition, he's been a distinguished fellow at the United States Institute for Peace, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies, also he was the head of the Director of Chinese Affairs at the Department of State. And now Ambassador Freeman is chairman of Projects International and the president of the Middle East Policy Council. He's co-chair of the U.S.-China Policy Council and vice chair of the Atlantic Council. He's the author of The Arts of Power, Statecraft and Diplomacy, and The Diplomat's Dictionary. And given that you worked, a member of the expert working group, Chaz Freeman, dealing with strategy, it seems that the president, after having gone through this extraordinarily difficult week, well, now, next week, apparently on Monday, he's to be briefed by Condoleezza Rice and her aides. Tuesday, he has a video conference with the military commanders in Iraq. And then on Wednesday, he goes to the Pentagon to get their review, which was commissioned by General Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So just in terms of this last week, though, Ambassador Freeman, it seems I don't think there's been anything quite like it, in the sense that the president of the United States was basically, it almost felt like an intervention went on. And the day before the Iraq Study Group, the nominee for Secretary of Defense said he's losing the war, a war that the president says he's winning. And then, you know, how strong the Iraq Study Group's opinions were. So just in terms of having watched Washington for some time, have you ever seen anything like this?
I don't really recall anything quite like it. I think in that sense, the Iraq Study Group, which I was very pleased to support, was quite successful in doing its main job, which was, I think, to open the possibility of a genuine debate and some civil discourse in the United States across the political divides about an issue which probably has no obvious or surefire solution to it.
And given that the president presumably has had this information for some time, or has been consistently given information by the CIA and the DIA and the people on the ground in Iraq of how bad things are, I guess in a way what happened on Wednesday was that the public was given a pretty cold shower. So what's your feeling in terms of whether the president has been known about this all along, or is this a case where, since the study group has gone public with such bad news and such almost alarm, that now the public is sort of entering the fray?
Well, I think the president and the administration allowed hope to triumph over accurate perception for quite a long while. And perhaps that's because this conflict in Iraq in many ways has become the centerpiece of the administration's policies, and they were naturally very reluctant to admit that things weren't going right. I think what the Iraq Study Group and perhaps the November elections as well brought home is that people who've been there and taken an independent look at it see it as going pretty badly.
But since the president in the press conference with Tony Blair, when confronted with the idea that perhaps he is in denial, as Woodward's book suggested, and asked bluntly whether he was capable of dealing with reality, did react somewhat petulantly. So the question that arises is that if this has been going on for some time, if he's known how bad the news is and yet hasn't wanted to effectively do anything about it, is he basically, is it almost like Groundhog Day, where they keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result?
Well, I really don't want to speculate about what the president might do. He certainly had a big dose of reality administered, as you said, and I suspect that the reports he'll hear this coming week will be emboldened to be equally blunt by the tone of the Baker-Hamilton report, which really doesn't pull any punches, analytically at least, and which admits that there may be no real answer to the dilemmas that we've gotten ourselves into.
So is there a resistance because, as you mentioned, the president's entire sort of presidency is tied up with Iraq. This is obviously almost a come to Jesus moment, I suppose.
Well, you know, if we had a parliamentary system, probably the government mm-hmm. would have fallen on this issue. But we don't. We have a presidential system, and this is our president for the next 2 years. And I think all of us need to try to help him do the right thing, even though perhaps we think he did the wrong thing mm-hmm. in going into Iraq and handling it the way that he did.
Is there a sort of a battle line here that one can divine that perhaps it's James Baker on the one hand and Dick Cheney on the other, since apparently he's been pretty much the architect and advocate for the status quo?
Well, I think there are clear battle lines being drawn, and you can see that in the reaction to the report in the country. Very passionate reactions from neoconservatives who deride the notion that it's necessary to talk to people in order to conduct diplomacy. They don't like the idea of talking to Iran or Syria. They certainly don't like the idea of addressing the Middle East in a comprehensive fashion, which those of us who have been out there and listened to people and watched the massive deterioration of the American political standing and position in the region consider is absolutely essential. So you have a combination of attacks on Mr. Baker and his character, or Mr. Hamilton and his alleged lack of realism. You have attacks on the notion of diplomacy, and you have some people, including Senator McCain, calling for reinforcing what many of us would think is failure with additional troops. And you also have, of course, the partisans of Israel attempting to detach those recommendations from the report and dismiss them as improper or irrelevant or somehow deeply misguided.
And those, of course, are the suggestions that the Israeli-Palestinian issue has to be solved. And apparently, from what I understand, and you'd be in a position to clarify this, is it not true that the Saudis and the Jordanians and the others who have almost publicly panicked about what's happening in Iran, in Iraq, and worried about Iran's hegemonic momentum here, that are they not sort of saying, We'd like to work with you and work with the Israelis, but you've got to, as a prerequisite, you've got to deal with the Palestinians.
Well, I think that's essentially correct. The effect of the continuing mayhem in Gaza and the West Bank has been to further radicalize populations in the Middle East, to reduce American standing to practically zero. I think the hostility to the United States is now so universal as to be indistinguishable from unanimity. And rulers in the region who do want to work with us find it extremely difficult to do so under these circumstances. So they think that in order for us to be able to work together on the wide range of issues that now exist, not just Iraq, but Lebanon, not just Lebanon, but the challenge of Iranian hegemony in the region, not just the Palestinian issue, but the entire package, they need to see a United States once again engaged in the pursuit of peace between Israelis and Arabs, and specifically a United States which is acting as it once did, to protect the Palestinians from the actions of the Israeli armed forces.
So, in other words, there's other battle lines here. In other, if there's a battle between Baker and Cheney, in effect, and it seems that they're incompatible, their positions are, and it may well be a kind of a mutually exclusive situation. There's also this broader battle where you've got, in fact, Baker was in effect the last one of the last American officials to actually stand up to the Israelis. So you've got on one side you've got AIPAC, the Congress, and the government of Israel, and the neocons, and then you've got Jim Bacon. Who else is in his corner?
Well, I think actually a fair number of people are. I mean, because there
Jimmy Carter, issues. By the way, is I think trying to be helpful in this regard.
Well, he has, like many people who've looked closely at the situation, come to some very unpleasant conclusions about what's going on, and also concluded that it has to end. And I think that's why he's spoken out. But I was going to say there are additional issues here. Does the United States remember how to practice diplomacy, or is our foreign policy simply sanctions followed up by the use of force? Do we have a foreign policy other than the use of our military? This is a pretty profound issue, and for some time the dominant strain in thought, probably since 9/11 in the United States, has been that foreign policy consists of using force to coerce people to do things, and it's not worthwhile trying to persuade them to do things. So, hence the very strong resistance to the notion of talking to people who, in many respects, are our adversaries, the Iranians and the Syrians, but who also hold the key to a world or a Middle East which is not worse than the one we already have, because I think that's the key thing that the report focused on, not just on whether it was possible for the United States to extricate itself from the ambush we walked into in Iraq, but whether we can do so in a way that prevents the situation from becoming even more dire and threatening our interests even more directly than it does at present.
But in terms of Iran, if indeed what appears to be true is true, that it's almost it's a state that doesn't know whether it's a state or a movement. There seems to be a division between state and society there. But there's apparently in a fairly an aggressive government under Ahmadinejad, And they've already got the successful model of Hezbollah in Lebanon. It seems that the al-Mahdi army may be what's in store for Iraq in terms of an Iranian surrogate. But on the other hand, so it's skeptical. One can be skeptical about what you can, what kind of deal you can make with Iran. But it does seem that Syria is in many ways. I've heard read op-eds back some time back suggesting in many ways you could almost buy the Syrians off, that they're ripe for plucking. I know it sounds a bit crude, but what's your sense?
Well, I think actually nobody ever said that the Iranians were particularly under this government were very nice or wouldn't pursue their own interests as they see them, nor will the Syrians they're not in the business of charity either. They're going to conduct their foreign relations in a tough-minded manner in a way that they see serving their interests. But I'd remind you that Iran was indeed quite helpful in Afghanistan when we confronted difficulties there after the withdrawal of the Soviet Union. And I recall from my time as ambassador in Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War of 1990-91 that the Iranians had multiple occasions on which they could have crossed the United States or done damage to our war effort. And they behaved quite responsibly. I think they were very surprised when, after the war in the Clinton administration, they found it impossible to conduct a dialogue with us. So it's not impossible if you can persuade even countries that you profoundly disagree with, like Iran, that things are in their interest as well as yours. It's not impossible sometimes to persuade them to cooperate on that basis. With respect to Syria, I think you're probably correct. The Syrians have indeed been sending many, many signals that they think it's time to make peace with Israel, that they're prepared to go back to the negotiating table, and that they think that there is a lot to talk with the United States about. Whether the dialogue with the Syrians would turn out to be fruitful or not, no one can know until we attempt it. The same is true of Iran. People who say, well, there's no point in talking to so-and-so because I know exactly what he'll say, sometimes find that they're surprised when they actually do talk to people. And I think it is true that not talking is not a strategy. Talking is also not a strategy, but you're much more likely to find a strategy if you talk to people than if you don't.
Well, it does seem though that the neoconservatives, their aggressive talk about Syria and mirroring the right wing Israeli position is counterintuitive for the state of Israel. If you were to knock off the Assad family regime, wouldn't it you be likely replaced by the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think a lot of Israelis have taken a hard look at the Bashar Assad government and concluded that anything that would be likely to replace it would be vastly worse. And I don't think the Israelis are now in the regime change business with respect to Syria. In fact, there's quite a number of intelligent people in Israel who believe that it is time for Israel to reopen its dialogue with Syria. And I think they're rather disappointed by the attitude of their supporters in the United States who counsel them against this.
So why then this rejection out of hand by Olmert, particularly, I guess, vis-a-vis the Palestinian issue?
Well, I think the Palestinian issue is, of course, a different one from Syria. But you've got to recall that Mr. Olmert and Mr. Sharon before him come from a long tradition of Israeli politics which has never wanted to talk to the Palestinians, which rejected the Madrid and Oslo process and deliberately set out to undermine it and discredit it, and which has always seen the path to security for Israel as being entirely unilateral. There's never been anyone on the Palestinian side whom this faction in Israel has seen as worthy of a meeting or a serious discussion. So there's really nothing new in this. I think the tragedy is that for essentially 6 years, the United States has suspended American judgment about these matters and allowed the Israeli right wing to do what it, whatever it wanted. And I think the results speak for themselves. They're catastrophic. Israel has not achieved security at all by the unilateral measures it's taken. So,
and we haven't helped because we basically turned Iraq into a failed state and moved al-Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe within a couple of hundred miles of Israel.
Well, what we've done is in Iraq is set up Jihad U, where, you know, if you flunk out, you get killed by the American forces. If you get a C, you get to hang around in Iraq and kill other Iraqis or foreigners. You get a B, you get to go blow up oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. And if you get an A, you get to go to Europe or North America and do big-time terrorism. So this has not been a very wise set of policies in those terms.
I thank you very much for joining us. I'm reminded of our last conversation where you referred to our diplomacy-free foreign policy and hit-and-run democracy. I think you could almost amend that to drive-by democracy.
So it hasn't worked.
Thank you again, Ambassador Freeman.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and Director of Chinese Affairs at the Department of State. And he was a member of the Iraq Study Group, part of the expert working group on strategy. I'm now speaking with Wayne White, who was also on the expert working group of the Iraq Study Group. He's a scholar at the Washington Near East Institute. He served as a deputy director for the Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. And he was chief of INR's Iran and Iraq Division and State Department representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups from 1990 to 2002. And Wayne White, the Secretary of State, on Saturday said, I've been doing some deep thinking on Iraq, which, if you don't mind, I'll share first with the president. And of course, the president is going to meet with her on Monday. I must say that after 4 years in Iraq, I think some deep thinking is overdue, is it not?
Very much overdue. Well, this is coming from the same individual when she was on the National Security Council, said she did not read the footnotes to the WMD NIE, which was one of the key reasons that we went to war.
She was also the person who came up with the line that we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
Exactly. Which, if she had read one of the footnotes, she might have been a little bit more relaxed about.
Well, didn't this Wednesday, events on Wednesday, really, I don't think there's ever been a situation like this where a sitting president is basically given a report card which more or less flunks him in the front of the whole world, and presumably he's known all along because you know he is getting the information. Whether he wants to deal with it or not is another matter, but he is getting the information. But now the information was so devastating, preceded by Bob Gates's remarks the day before, that I guess there's no way that the president can ignore it. Is that the purpose of this group, a kind of shock therapy?
It's very interesting that the group essentially morphed from its creation in the spring, which evoked little interest relative to what we're seeing now. And then gradually, month by month, the situation in Iraq grew steadily worse, increasing the number of people who were looking to this group in order to come up with something, which brought forth from people like Secretary Baker, accurate comments like there aren't any silver bullets. In other words, trying to dampen expectations from a group that was hardly noticed when it was created.
Well, it's It's almost, though, when you look at what Senator Gordon Smith, a conservative senator from Oregon, made a speech on the Senate floor on Friday, which was quite impassioned, albeit low-key, where he said that every day the strategy in Iraq vis-a-vis our use of the military is that the soldiers go out on patrol the same streets in the same way with the same vehicles, and they get blown up by the same bombs. And he said, you know, it's absurd. And then he said it also could be criminal. So
it's almost worse than that, Ian, because one of the things that's come to light very recently, I think, in fact, in the last month or so, is that as our units have rotated in and out of the country, some units being on their third or fourth or even approaching their fifth rotation, they've often been rotating into different areas and learning all over again what they learned about the original area they patrolled, and they found that in these rotations there is a tremendous spike in casualties on returning units within the first 30 days of their deployment, because they have to learn every corner, every dangerous house, every place where the insurgents most likely plant an IED. And so even rotating our forces hasn't been done competently.
But this feels a bit like Groundhog Day to me. If the president is there in the White House, and for the last couple of years he's been getting the bad news, and we keep doing the same thing. It's like Einstein's definition of insanity. It's doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Is it because the president because his prestige is on the line, just simply can't face reality and is just hoping for a miracle?
I think there is some truth to that, and he should read page 59. Of the Iraq Study Group report, which says, literally, quote, we should expect no miracles. Because he, I think, has been in denial. But I think it's easy to be in a White House in denial if your immediate advisors, in this case, unusually for a presidency, the vice president in particular, and Don Rumsfeld, were essentially blocking dissonant views, discouraging views from reaching him. And that's the danger of being surrounded by advisors who launched the war, who launched it on various incorrect assumptions, and then were in the midst of trying to vindicate themselves, as opposed to advise the president properly on what was really happening out there.
Well, I asked Ambassador Freeman this same question, which is, are the battle lines then between Jim Baker and Dick Cheney? In other words, it's either one or the other. It's a mutually exclusive situation. If they there's no way that these two power groups are compatible. Is that what I'm to assume? That's really the subtext of what's happening now in Washington.
I don't know. I don't know whether that subset works that way. In fact, there's a sort of an irony about the report, which I'm a little bit, I'm disappointed by the report. I don't wonder. Chaz mentioned it, but the expert advisors to the group, like Chaz and me, and Chaz and I worked side by side in many, many meetings, were essentially excluded from the commissioners for the last 2 months, you know, of the process. They were, I think, jarred by leaks and things like that, and we could send things into them, but, you know, there was no interchange like we had at certain meetings earlier. But I was surprised at some of the proposals, because they flew in the face of some of what was going on in their previous interaction with us. And for example, in our last meeting, just under half of the attending experts voted for withdrawal. Now, in the face of that, with Middle East experts who know full well the gravity associated with withdrawal and its consequences, but still viewing withdrawal as about the only thing we could do in the face of the increasingly damaged situation on the ground, they put out a plan that I think carries a lot of false hope. Once you get beyond the dismal assessment, you get into the series of recommendations which implicitly say that it can be made to work if you do this. And I think there's a significant gap between the dreary assessment and the recommendations on the other side. And like I mentioned, that there was an issue that I had pointed out to the commissioners, and that was the Army. That the Army, as constituted, and it can't be turned around in a matter of less than years, is mainly a Shia Kurdish army. And the moment it takes over security duties in predominantly Sunni Arab areas, Sunni Arabs will rush to arms and form effectively a Sunni Arab militia. It's already happening in some neighborhoods, in some areas, in mixed areas of the country. And in mixed areas of, that of the country, that army will probably propel the process of ethnic cleansing, of booting Sunni Arabs out. And I engaged in a long discussion. In fact, it was with Senator Robb and Justice O'Connor in our sessions that they were particularly interested in this. But nonetheless, out come a bunch of recommendations which seemingly indicate that you can take this army and get it, you know, bang together into something that can unify Iraq. And that's just not, not going to happen. And most people who have taken a good hard look at it say the problem with the Army isn't so much training, it's loyalty.
So in other words, the Iraq Study Group is a cold shower, but at the last minute they put a little warm water in it.
Exactly. Exactly. Too much, far too much warm water in it. In fact, you know, if once the president gets beyond being wounded and humiliated justifiably for misleading the country and for bungling, you know, things, actually this could be very good for him. It allows him essentially to stay in Iraq in some manner all the way through to the end of his presidency. In other words, even if troops, combat units are largely out by early 2008, there'll be a substantial advisory presence and the presence of a few rapid response units, probably to the end of his presidency. I assume the situation is going to continue to deteriorate, and so probably if his successor is at all reasonable, that person will have to get out. And then Mr. Bush will be able to write in his memoirs, shamelessly, that he didn't cut and run, but his successor did, and maybe if he had been allowed to continue on, everything would have been fine.
Well, I think that there's a lot of talk that that's indeed what that is what the president is trying to achieve. He wants to kick the can down the road, and he doesn't want to have to be the person who admits failure and has to get out. So, but do you believe that this dragging out the agony is feasible, given the alarm with which Gates referred to the civil war turning into a regional war, and indeed that was echoed by the Iraq Study Group? That's the headline.
I know, and that is mainly associated with a withdrawal scenario, where we basically stop holding down the pot, you know, the top of the kettle. On civil war and what have you. And believe me, I fear scenarios like that. But we're doing a lot of bleeding and dying in order to hold down that that kettle out there. And I don't know whether if you stay there 2, 3, 4, or 5 more years that you would make it any better when you finally did leave. Very, very pessimistic about the situation. It's very interesting that in mid-summer we discussed the Biden proposal in our sessions, and no one was the least bit interested in this.
That's the idea of breaking it up.
Dividing Iraq up, right. Staying in some manner of a federal union, but distinctly dividing up the country into ethno-sectarian, and a triad of ethno-sectarian pieces. And now, I'm not nearly as opposed to the Biden plan, because it's being implemented on the ground as we speak. That had become evident by about 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, as neighborhoods in Baghdad are emptying out. Various towns and villages have already been cleansed. And so the ugly separating out of the populations that we feared so much is ongoing.
But just in closing, Wayne White, I mentioned that it seems to me the battle lines are between Jim Baker and the previous, the father's group and Dick Cheney. And I can't see, I mean, in a way, I can't see if Baker is to be successful, I think Cheney has to go. At least that's my opinion. And obviously they could replace the vice president with somebody that might help them in 08, like Rice, for example.
Right.
Our favorite.
The problem is you can't replace an elected vice president. He has to resign.
He has to resign. But
it's something that's almost unprecedented in American history, with the exception of, I guess, Spiro Agnew, who was involved in a criminal.
But if the president says, I just cannot work with you anymore, you have to go, I think they could probably find some cosmetic health reasons.
I don't know that they could. You know, if you go back to as much as I wish Dick Cheney was out, if you go back to early America, and we had this bizarre situation where the vice president was usually the defeated presidential candidate, and the vice president often was just off in a corner sulking, you know, for a four-year term. You can have a vice president at odds with everything that the president values, and he's still vice president.
Well, just in the other battle line, though, I think that's pretty clear, is that it's Baker and company versus AIPAC, the Congress,
right,
the Israelis, and the neocons.
Very much so. And that crowd is the consensus crowd. And that is a word that the neoconservatives and others are terrified. Because this is something they've never sought, never wanted, and it's happening.
Right. But their war has turned into the biggest strategic disaster in American history. So it's amazing that those people are still appearing on television and in op-ed print. I thank you very much for joining us, Wayne White.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Wayne White, who's a former deputy director of the INR, which is the State Department's Intelligence Bureau. He was their expert on the Iran-Iraq desk. Let's now go to Stephen Biddle. I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Biddle, who is a senior fellow in defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. He's also the author of an article in the March issue of Foreign Affairs, Seeing Baghdad, Thinking Saigon. And clearly, Dr. Biddle, the president's been getting information all along about how bad things are in Iraq from the normal sources that serve the number one consumer of intelligence. So, what do you think was achieved by the public announcements this week of the Iraq Study Group? It's as though they were informing the public how bad things are, rather than the president, who presumably knew how bad things are.
Well, partly there's a public information function involved, but largely there's a political function involved. I think many people had hoped that what the commission would do was make it possible, if the president wanted one, to get a bipartisan approach for either the further conduct of the war or for getting out if he were to decide that that's what he wanted to do. The commission gave him an olive leaf and made it possible to do that. Whether he's going to choose to do that is another thing altogether.
So what's going on then if the president acknowledges, as he did in the press conference with Tony Blair, how bad things are, but then essentially he repeats slogans?
Well, I hope that he's going to decide on a significant change of strategy. And again, politically, the commission gives him an opportunity to do that. But if he doesn't want to, it's very, very hard to force that. And if he doesn't, I think we're going to end up with failure in Iraq.
Well, isn't it possible that that's already happening? That then, in effect, what might be going on here is that we're whistling past the graveyard, but our commander-in-chief simply can't deal with the reality because his entire prestige is on the line.
Well, there's no guarantee of a tolerable outcome in Iraq. I mean, it is entirely possible that the situation could be out of our ability to control and that the situation is irretrievably lost. The stakes are high enough, though, that I think it's worth trying to pull a rabbit out of the hat, trying to pull the chestnuts out of the fire, how many other cliches I can bring to bear on this particular issue. But it's worth trying to take even a long-shot chance to stabilize the situation and come away with something other than the worst case in Iraq, even if you can't rule out the worst case, regardless of what you do?
Well, a very prominent conservative U.S. Senator, Republican Gordon Smith, made a rather passionate low-key, if you will, speech on the Senate floor and breaking with the president and indicating that he felt, even though he admitted he's not a military man, he felt that it didn't make any sense that every day the soldiers go out the same route, the same time, the same place, and they get blown up by the same IEDs. And he said it's absurd, the strategy is absurd, and then he said it could even be criminal. So what explains this paralysis? If the senator's true that essentially we've just been, you know, almost like Groundhog Day, doing this activity there that doesn't have a strategic purpose, it seems, is that, if he's correct, does that mean that the president's not just dealing with the military reality?
Well, all I can say on that is that there aren't any particularly attractive options. I mean, at some level, it's understandable that the president doesn't immediately say, let us boldly go forth and do X, because X looks terrible. So does Y, so does Z, so does everything else. I mean, what you're doing is you're compelled to choose the least bad from among a pretty bad menu of options, and that kind of thing doesn't make people really enthusiastic about getting on with the business of choosing one. Now, that having been said, if we don't, the lack of choice is going to produce a near certainty of failure. So at the moment, I think the business of picking your favorite brand of castor oil, gritting your teeth, closing your eyes, and swallowing hard is the order of the hour, and we need to get on with it fast. But it's not an attractive thing to do, and I can understand at some level why the president, other things being equal, would rather not do that.
And what would your prescription, what would your castor oil involve?
Well, I think it starts with the recognition that the problem in Iraq right now is terminating an ongoing civil war. It's not preventing one, we've got one. And ordinarily, the way you terminate ongoing civil wars is you compel a power-sharing compromise among the parties that produces a ceasefire. You then enforce the ceasefire with outsiders. The indigenous military can't do that because nobody trusts one another within the country. The problem we've got at the moment is on both ends of that standard cookbook for terminating a civil war. The parties don't want to take the risks associated with compromise because they consider those risks as leading to a danger of genocide down the road if they miscalculate slightly. And we don't have any outsiders lining up looking for opportunities to come in and do peacekeeping duty in Iraq. So if there's going to be some long-term enforcement by somebody outside the indigenous conflict, it would have to be us. And the public is losing patience with the U.S. presence. So if you're going to square the circle and fix those two problems, you need both a bigger source of leverage to drive parties who don't want to compromise to do it anyway, and a commitment, if that compromise produces a truce, to keep U.S. troops around rather than withdrawing them as soon as the shooting dies down. And I think the only prospects for increasing the leverage on the parties to make them compromise are a couple of the options that are in the Baker-Hamilton report, a diplomatic opening to the Iranians and the Syrians, which I think is a long way from a panacea. There are all sorts of problems with it, but we need to get something if we're going to get off the mark here. And although it's imperfect, I think it's worth trying. And second, we have to make our military support for the Iraqi government contingent on whether or not they're willing to produce a reconciliation deal, a power-sharing compromise. If we continue to make promises that we will stay there until and unless the Iraqi military can handle the problem, that removes their incentives to take risks for compromise.
But as far as I understand, Dr. Stephen Biddle, the Iraqi military that we often refer to would more accurately be described as the Peshmerga units that are apparently the best and most reliable. The restists are hopelessly infiltrated by either Sunni or Shia death squads and insurgents. So, is that, am I correct in that?
Well, whether you think they're penetrated with death squad members, or whether you think they're simply sympathetic to the sectarian factions in the country. I think clearly the one of the central problems we've got in the country at the moment is we think of the Iraqi military as a non-sectarian nationalist instrument representing the interests of all Iraqis. The way Sunnis think of the Iraqi national military is that it's a Shiite Kurdish ethnic militia on steroids.
Right.
So the whole strategy we've had heretofore of build up the Iraqi military so that the national military can carry on the fight after we simply go away and hand the problem into their laps has the effect of making the fighting worse, not better, because the Sunnis, the stronger we make what the Sunnis view as their rival, the national military, the harder they fight back in a conflict that they see as having genocidal stakes, so they can't very readily just give in to what the national military wants. So that strategy has been part of the problem.
And it appears, it's manifesting itself in such a way that it looks as though the Shia are bent on ethnically cleansing the Sunni from Baghdad. And you, as far as I can see, you can't help look at this situation also in terms of perhaps even a surrogate war where you have Iran backing the Shia and Sunni states, you know, quietly and even more openly now backing the kind of Sunni redoubt in al-Anbar, which appears to be where the Shia want to drive them.
I think that's exactly what's going on. But part of the problem in this is that much as the Shiites are trying to ethnically cleanse parts of Baghdad, so are the Sunnis. I mean, there aren't any sort of George Washingtonian, Jeffersonian, you know, forces of liberty and goodness in Iraq right now, or at least those that are there are getting increasingly marginalized. That the problem we're stuck with in Iraq is taking a collection of actors, most of whom have some really unsavory elements to them, and somehow trying to maneuver them all or manipulate them all into compromising with one another. It's not a situation where we can very easily identify a party that represents the good guys, back them to the hilt. I mean, there are very few good guys, unambiguously good guys, in Iraq at the moment.
And more, I would think more importantly, Dr. Biddle, is that there doesn't seem to be any overarching unifying concept here that these factions, whether they're tribal warlords or religiously based, can agree to.
Yeah, the nationalist idea of Iraq has been getting less and less salient every week since 2003. And it's understandable that would be the case. I mean, we would like some Iraqi nationalist to rise up and unify the country. The trouble is Iraqis at the moment feel desperately threatened by sectarian rivals. And they're so worried about death squads from the other side that they think the only way they can protect themselves is by relying on the only people they can trust, which is their own confessional group. So in that kind of environment where people think their lives are on the line and the only protectors of their lives and livelihood are their own clan or their own sect or their own ethnic group, it's just very, very hard for this rather abstract notion of the Iraqi nation to rise to the fore and to enable some national government to suppress the fighting.
And you have to add to this, of course, the professionals and the secular Iraqis and the Christians are getting out in droves. There's up to 2 million already have left, a lot in the pipeline. Jordan is under strain from its 1 million-plus Iraqis and Syria likewise. And it does seem that Jordan is a pretty frail state, and if that's where the Sunni insurgency is being organized from and where the Baathists, who are, I believe, quite a big part of the Sunni effort. Little wonder King Abdullah has a strident sort of scent, note of panic in his voice.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think he isn't? I mean, everybody that spoke this week, starting with Bob Gates and then Baker Hamilton, kept reiterating that this could spin into a regional war, and apparently the Saudis and the Jordanians have been apparently shouting in our ear for some time about this.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. And certainly the most severe threat to U.S. national interests in this entire conflict is that it might spread into a regional war. And there many, many civil wars do this. It's very common in what looks like a nominally civil war to get initially low-grade, under-the-table assistance in what amounts to a proxy conflict in which neighbors intervene by sending money and arms to their brethren within the war, within the country that's engaged in a civil war. But often it spreads to large-scale military intervention by neighbors. And if we end up with large-scale military intervention somewhere 5, 6, 10 years down the road in which the Syrians or the Iranians or some collection of Jordanians, Saudis, and Egyptians end up engaged in interstate warfare spurred by a civil conflict within Iraq, the result could be a catastrophe for U.S. national interests.
So, just in closing then, Dr. Stephen Biddle, is it possible, given the deteriorating circumstances, that if the president probably privately knows there are no good options, but can't accept defeat, but doesn't know how to secure victory, and has been paralyzed for some time, presumably, could he kick the can down the road for another 2 years, maintain some kind of military presence there and sort of monitor the chaos and hand it over to his successor? Or do you think it has to be dealt with now?
I think this turns on congressional Republicans. If the president holds his own party in the Congress, he can, if he chooses to, dig in his heels, refuse to change, and carry on current policy until 2008. If he holds his own party on the Hill, he has the power to do that. Democrats' only option to stop the war or to change policy, if he chooses to do that, is to defund the war, and they've said over and over and over again they're not willing to do that. On the other hand, if the president loses congressional Republicans, and it's beginning to look like he might, if he insists on staying the course or something that looks a whole lot like staying the course, he encounters much, much more serious difficulty. So I think the key turns at the moment on members of his own party who are trying so far to stay under the radar screen and not come out in opposition to the war, but that are very unhappy about the war. Congressional Republicans want us out almost as much as congressional Democrats want us out. They're reluctant to say so publicly while the president is on the other side of the issue. Whether they'll continue to be so reticent remains to be seen.
Well, but the president appears sort of, at least in the press conference with Tony Blair, to be sort of churlish and almost petulant in his resistance. As I say, he offers slogans, but not solutions. And I just wonder if I understand that privately what he's saying. Almost like, how dare they do this to me? I'm not going to outsource the presidency, you know. And I think for the first time, the American people, I've never seen anything like this, where a sitting president, there's a sort of intervention goes on. I would think it's deeply embarrassing for the president to be in this situation. And he doesn't seem to be very happy about it, and little wonder.
Little wonder indeed. I mean, however unpleasant the situation may feel right now, imagine how much less pleasant it'll be if ranking Republicans in the Senate and House Armed Services Committee bolt. It could get a lot less pleasant than it is now before this thing is over.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Stephen Biddle. I guess the coming days will tell whether there is some direction here in terms of what many are describing as the worst strategic mistake in the history of the United States. I mean, that sounds like hyperbole, but former presidents and former vice presidents are saying this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Quite possibly so.
Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Stephen Biddle, who's a senior fellow in defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battles. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer. I'd like to thank today's engineer, G.